Everybody on tape? Good. You taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Cooperative presents Earth on the Air.
During the next 30 minutes, Earth on the Air's independent contributors explore money. What is it really?
The frugality movement. Is it a 90s trend?
Author Ernest Kallenbach talks about a sustainable planet.
A visit to Cerro Gordo, a new community striving to be a model of sustainability.
Satire, storytelling,
and more.
What is money, really? What do you think money is?
I think it's something that enables you to do the things that you want.
Money is a barter system that replaces things that are unequal in value.
It's an illusion. It doesn't really exist. You just pass it around, it comes right back to you.
Money is modern man's fear. He uses it at 7-Eleven every day.
Money is just an addiction.
It controls everybody's life.
Why does it control everybody's life?
Because everybody wants it.
How much money do you want?
A lot. I want at least a couple thousand right now.
How much money do you think you really need?
A couple thousand.
Just enough to get by.
Basically enough to pay the rent and pay all my bills.
A little bit more than I earn.
If you had $5, would you give it to me?
No.
Can you have some of it? No.
Why not?
Because I worked for my money and there's no reason for me to give it to you.
Because I don't have any to give away.
Well, you feel like if you won the lottery, you'd share it. I'm not sure that's true, but you feel like you would when you don't have it.
If you had a couple thousand, could I have some?
Yeah.
Really, why?
Because I like buying gifts for people, and I share. So, when I have money, I like to share it.
Money, 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 money,
money. Bank's gonna reopen next week.
But, George, I've got my money here.
Did he guarantee this place?
Well, no, Charlie, I didn't even ask him. We don't need Potter over here.
And I'll take mine now.
No, but you're thinking of this place all wrong, as if I had the money back in a safe. The money's not here. Well, your money's in Joe's house. That's right next to yours. And in the Kennedy house, and Mrs. Maitland's house, and 100 others.
As Jimmy Stewart points out so eloquently, money can be an elusive entity, which is what Alan Atkison discovered recently. Alan is the editor of In Context magazine, a journal of humane, sustainable living.
Not long ago, a new credit card dropped into my life, and I suddenly felt an urgent need to find the answer to the question, what is money? I knew the usual definitions. Money is a medium of exchange, a measure of value, a store of wealth. But these phrases reveal nothing of the essential mystery of money. So I started searching. The dictionary just deepened the mystery. The word money comes from the Latin word monere, which means to admonish or to warn. The word was also the surname for Juno, matriarch of the gods, in whose temple at Rome money was coined. This news wasn't very encouraging. It was early in my search, and I was already receiving warnings from the gods. But I pressed on, dodging lightning bolts left and right, and posed the question to a couple of sages I know. One, an astrophysicist, noted that money is a convenient way to lose a lot of information. When you buy a new shirt, you have no way of seeing the cotton fields, oil wells, plastics factories, or impoverished Asian laborers who contributed to its production, because the money effectively hides all that. A second sage, a former Wall Street analyst, told me that money was our life energy. You see, we spend about a third of our lives converting that energy into money, usually through jobs. We spend another third spending the money, and the last third tossing and turning in our sleep, because we're worried about money. Then this same sage told me a story about a Mexican village, so remote there was often no money, not a single peso in the whole town. Even under those conditions, he reported, people still invent money. I'll give you 3 hours of my time for a couple of those fish, they might say. I was puzzled. Why don't they just give the fish and their time to each other? That's when it hit me. The dangerous truth about money. It's the opposite of a gift. A gift is an expression of love and trust and community. Money, therefore, is an expression of our distrust and fear and our basic separation from each other. It's not a measure of value. It's a measure of our lack of love. They say that money is the root of all evil. But maybe that's backwards. Maybe evil is the root of all money.
Alan Atkison edits In Context magazine from Bainbridge Island, Washington.
$10 bills.
Oh my God.
$50 bills. $100 bills.
Next, on Earth on the Air, Antonio Noel is a barterer, not because he thinks money is the root of all evil, more because he likes the social aspects of trading. He wanted to share a bit about why people barter, so he took his tape recorder to the Ferry County Barter Fair near his home in eastern Washington and sent Earth on the Air this tape of some of the participants.
How much is this, $9 worth?
There's no false pretenses or holier-than-thou attitudes, and everybody's just people.
Everything stops just to come here and enjoy it.
It has this whole social aspect about it.
60, 80 years ago, we used to, our ancestors used to ride 100, 200 miles to a place where they'd sit up on the river and barter for fish, for food, to last through the winter, and that's the basis of barter fair, was to provide for the winter and have a good winter.
I primarily deal with ginseng and herbs and healing things.
Whatever I've got around the house or stuff that I've accumulated throughout the years.
Like yarn, dried fruits, homemade items that I put my energy and my feelings into when I make them.
But I like the barter aspect that you can trade and that things have only the value in which you place on them.
Like if you want to buy something in a store, you need money. But I would prefer not to run on money. I'd prefer just to exchange deeds between people. So money's a funny one for me because it's something I don't usually have a lot of. So I've learned to live a lot without it.
The more that you get, the more that you want to get.
It used to be a big thing to me, but as I went through schooling and started traveling, I realized that it's not the answer to life.
I get what I need, and I'm quite happy with that.
I really resent money being the bottom line for our whole political activity. I think gold being on the bottom line is a totally foolish value system. We should have air and soil and clean water and things like that is our bottom line.
Money is probably the largest problem that we have in the United States. The rich are getting rich, the poor stay poor, and the people who learn to survive without money are the people who are going to survive in this world. The rich are going to end up losing it eventually.
And I want my money!
Will you quiet down?
I want my $200.
I don't have your $200 no more, and you know it.
If you don't give me my $200, I'm going to tell a policeman how you got it, and he'll make you give it to me because it's mine.
But I don't have it.
Then get it.
Next, Vicky Robin and Joe Dominguez. They're directors of the nonprofit New Roadmap Foundation. Money is a preoccupation at New Roadmap, partly because Joe is an ex-Wall Street investor and analyst. The group offers a course on transforming your relationship with money. Most of the proceeds from the course go toward funding other nonprofit endeavors. They help support Earth on the Air, for example. Joe and Vicky say that in our striving for more money and possessions, we've lost the ability to enjoy enoughness. But they think we're on the verge of a turnaround, and the 1990s will be the decade of frugality.
Frugality has this kind of aura of penny pincher, you know, tightwad. You know, it has this kind of squozing out, dry, desiccated prune feeling to it, you know. But it's really not. Frugality has the same root as the word fruit. And what it really is about is the pleasure we take in the use or possession of something. Enoughness is not about cutting back to where you're suffering. It's about cutting back to that point where the excess is gone, the stuff that doesn't matter to you anyway.
We tried the excess path, the path of excess in the 80s. It didn't work. It didn't give more fulfillment. People in poll after poll are not happier than they were in 1970. On balance, we can live as good a life today with the same income as we did 20 years ago if our expectations, our attitudes, and so on hadn't been perverted, if you will, hadn't gone along with the mass psychosis of we gotta have it all. And of course, everything we're saying here is we're talking about middle class and above. We're not talking about the poverty classes. I am living personally in the same income now as I was 20 years ago. And I'm perfectly happy. And that's a $6,000 a year income. Now, that when I say that to people, it blows them away. And yet, as you know, I live in a comfortable house. I'm reasonably well-dressed. You know, there's nothing grossly poverty-stricken about my lifestyle, and I certainly don't feel it. But why should that be so foreign, such a foreign concept to people when I mention this? Especially when you look at the rest of the world, you know, that this 5% of the population has such outrageous expectations of its economy and of its living standard that we forget what the rest of the world lives at. And are we all that much happier?
People in the rest of the world, and I don't want to ennoblize people who live at a lower standard of living, quote-unquote, than we do here in North America, but by and large, people in other countries, what they have when they don't have money to buy their way out of problems or to buy entertainment or to buy distractions, what they have is other people. I sometimes say that there should be some first world development work that people who have not yet lost their cultural cohesiveness, not yet lost the ability to just have a family, have a good time by sitting around together and talking after dinner for an evening, late into the night, telling stories. And those are the things that we've lost. Those are the things we've sacrificed. And those are the things that we can reclaim as we pull back on using money as the solution to every discomfort that we have.
The New Roadmap Foundation's new book is called Your Money or Your Life: Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Achieving Financial Independence. It'll be published in 1992 by Viking Press.
If the snacks are less than $2.25, you have won $10,000. The snacks are... You did not win $10,000, and you lost this $1,000, yes.
Value chicken.
Today, we find Value Chicken after midnight in one of the thousands of identical mini-marts springing up like Pop-Tarts all across the land.
It sure is comforting to know that I can use this cash machine here to get cash to buy M&Ms anytime, day or night.
Hello, Value Chicken, bird with no feathers.
Why, it talks. Now that's the kind of personal touch that I like.
Withdrawal.
La-dee-da.
From checking. Please enter amount in multiples of
$100. $100? And I thought $20 was unreasonable. But I don't want $100. I only want $500. Wait a minute. Stop. Cancel. I only want $5, not $500.
Okay. $5. Are you sure 5 will hold you over? Here, let me give you 40. Get something nice for yourself. You deserve it.
Something nice? Well, but I don't want 40. I only have $23 in my account.
Well, sure, that's what your checkbook says, but your rent check still hasn't cleared. That means your available balance is $385, and that means you qualify for our weekend pre-check clearing loan. I saw the way you were looking at that indoor ski machine in JCPenney the other day.
Well, I haven't been getting out much lately. Wait a minute, I don't want a ski machine. All I want is $5 for a bag of M&Ms.
Okay, $5. Coming right up. You look tired. Have you been getting enough sleep?
Well, no, actually, I haven't.
How does a weekend in Aruba sound?
Weekend in Aruba?
Why don't I just book you a reservation on the plane and a hotel near the beach? Oh, heck. Let's go right on the beach, shall we? Now, did you want that single or double occupancy?
Single or double occupancy? No, no, no. Now look here. All I want is $5 so I can get a bag of M&Ms. I don't want an indoor ski machine, and I don't want a weekend in Aruba.
Okay, okay. $5, bag of M&Ms. Sheesh, how boring.
Look here. Just give me my card back.
Wait a minute. Hold on. I'll give you the $5.
I don't want it anymore. Just give me my card.
Not that. Don't take your card, but please.
Cancel. No,
wait,
card.
How about $4? $3? Take $3 and I'll throw in 3,000 frequent flyer miles on Air Aruba.
Just give me the plastic.
Fine. Have it your way. What kind of American are you anyway? Don't you know that you're supposed to spend more than you have? Oh, how I pine for the days of Donald Trump. At least the government still sees things my way.
Just give me my statement slip.
Figure it out for yourself. I'm out of paper.
And so Value Chicken safely navigates the stormy waters of temptation. Tune in next time for another episode of...
Value Chicken.
Value Chicken is the creation of freelance writers Tom Baer and Brent Hardinger. Next, John Mullen. He's a writer, performance artist, entrepreneur, and regular contributor to Earth on the Air.
I always wanted to make a lot of money so I could buy my mother and father things they couldn't afford because they had 7 kids. My mom wanted a new sofa because the one we had made your head look like it was attached to your knees when you sat down on it. I knew that if I could make a lot of money and buy my mom a new couch, she would love me more than any of her other kids. But making money was hard. There wasn't a lot of jobs for 7-year-olds, so I had to make my own. I started with Kool-Aid stands, and while I waited for customers, I'd plan out what I was going to do with all the money I was about to make and how surprised and eternally grateful my family would be when my father could quit his job because of my incredibly successful business. The Kool-Aid stands brought in a few coins, but they were always gone in a couple days, so I moved on to bigger businesses, like my bed-making scheme. My older brothers and sisters who had jobs didn't like making their beds and hated hearing my mother holler about it, so I got them to give me a quarter a day to make their beds and put their dirty clothes in the hamper. This didn't last long because none of them liked forking over $1.25 a week to a little kid. They thought it was too much money for me, but I wasn't going to do it for less, so one by one they fired me. I went on through a series of businesses, cleaning out cars, sweeping sidewalks, cutting grass, finally reaching my childhood pinnacle, a paper route. It was my first steady money, and I had big plans for how I was going to spend it. First, I'd get the couch, but it was $300, and I couldn't even save $3. Some weeks, I didn't even have enough to pay for my papers and had to borrow to pay my bill. This was discouraging, but I started understanding something important about money. It's a Chinese finger trap. The harder you pull at it, the more stuck in it you get. Like this time one of my customers, Mrs. Rizzo, had a $4.20 bill and didn't want to answer her door. I decided that maybe she didn't like knocking, so I tried kicking instead. She came out and sprayed me with bug poison. I kicked harder and she threw a kettle of hot water at me through the screen door. I kept on kicking and she came out with a stick and beat me until I ran off her front porch. Yep, money is definitely a finger trap. I still invent my jobs and businesses, but now I know not to grab so hard for the money. When I don't focus too much on it, enough always comes. I figure the same rule applies to my parents because they just bought a new couch and I didn't have to give them a dime.
Well, well, what have we here? Young enterprise at work?
We're all sold out, Uncle Scrooge, and we're rich. We made 56 cents.
I tip my tam-o-shanter to you. Now then, who's that, net or gross?
Well, you just stepping on the lemons was a little gross, but no one complained.
Next on Earth on the Air, Ernest Kallenbach. In his political novel, Ecotopia, people are appreciated for what they produce in human relationships, in art, in community life, science, politics. And to call someone a consumer is an insult.
You may remember that about 2,000 years ago, a man ran around the Middle East saying, "Blessed are the poor," which was not a welcome message then, and it's not a welcome message now. But the reason for it ecologically is that people who spend less money, either because they don't have it or because they don't want to spend it or because they don't want to earn it in the first place and would rather have the time for themselves, these people are doing less damage to the environment, and if that makes them blessed, I say that's a great thing to keep in mind.
Kallenbach has devised a principle that relates money, health, and the environment. He calls his principle the Green Triangle.
If you envisage a triangle, and one point of it is helping your health, and one point of it is helping the environment, and the third point is helping your pocketbook, it just so turns out that if you try to help any one point of this triangle, you will help all the other two as well. Let's take an example, for example, maybe your health. You're worried about your health. You're aware that eating a lot of red meat or fatty desserts or baked goods is likely to clog up your arteries and lead to an earlier death than you would otherwise have. You stop eating so much of these things, maybe even stop them entirely. That's going to help your pocketbook because those foods are more expensive than most other foods, but it's also going to help the environment because producing beef is a relatively wasteful process environmentally. Let's say you take another point of the triangle. You want to do something to help the environment. The single biggest thing you can probably do to help the environment is to drive your car less or not drive at all. And you try doing that. But you will notice that that, of course, will save you a lot of money because operating a car is probably taking at least an eighth, and for some people more like a fifth or even a quarter of your income. So you're helping fight air pollution. You're also keeping your pocketbook from being depleted. And lo and behold, you're also helping your health because if you drive less, you will walk more, even if it's only to and from the bus, or you may live in a place where you can walk to work or you can walk to your shopping, or you may ride a bicycle. And those things, of course, are all good for your health. So if you want to do something for the environment, if you want to do something for your health, and Lord knows most of us want to do something for our pocketbook, you can start anywhere. They all work together.
Ernest Kallenbach says if we don't learn to practice balanced, sustainable lifestyles, then we should start preparing a tombstone for our nation. Sustainable is a word Kallenbach uses a lot.
You can speak of the sustainability of an ecosystem, for example, of a forest. If you cut it in wrong ways, the forest will cease to be as productive as it used to be, and species within it will not be able to live there anymore. But you can also talk about sustainability for the human species. And Lester Brown of the World Watch Organization put it, I think, about as well as anybody in a simplified form, that we operate sustainably when we do things so as not to diminish the chances of future generations.
That's Regina playing on a friend's front porch that looks out onto the valley and the budding eco-village of Cerro Gordo. It's just outside of Cottage Grove, Oregon. For now, there's only a dozen citizens in this community on a fat hillside on Dorena Lake. They share some impressions of their new home, which they're hoping will become a model of sustainability, one that balances economic and ecological interests.
Yeah, I thought, well, if I can do this and do it with a group of people that I developed as my best friends, and then, you know, my dream went on further. Boy, what if I took all of my best friends that we got together and we were able to build a neighborhood? And then it went on a step further. Well, what if we could do this as a model and show people how they can do it, even in urban areas?
Community isn't really a thing. It's what you do, and it's really the relationship between the various parts of your lives. So if we can bring those parts of our lives closer together, more in harmony with one another, then we can regain that sense of community, not only within the human community here, but also with the natural community by integrating this village with this ecosystem in this little valley.
You know, it offers a place where people who really want to build a community can do it. That is how a community is built, face-to-face interaction and working together. That's why suburbs are so barren, you know, because people don't talk to each other. They get in their cars and they go someplace else. Well, in this place, you can't do that.
And so by walking from our home to work on the forest trail, we get a sense of the larger community of the biosphere and helps us remember who we are.
It's a lot of work, like Steve and Brady here digging ditches or learning to respect rattlesnakes, the fact that there's at least two packs of coyotes running around here.
Sustainable eco-cities like Cerro Gordo are nothing new. The garden city of Letchworth, England, was designed in 1903 to be relatively self-sufficient. Paolo Saleri designed Arco Santi, Arizona, to be an experiment in compact and energy-efficient living. Chris Canfield and other eco-city enthusiasts have been working on Cerro Gordo for 21 years. Their zoning plan was finally approved this past year. Canfield's goal is a symbiosis of village, farm, and forest for up to 2,500 people. Homes, businesses, and community facilities will be clustered around a 200-acre pedestrian village, preserving 1,000 acres of forest and meadow.
Of course, when we first came out here, most of us came from the city, and we all wanted elbow room. We wanted to get away from being crowded or feeling like too many people were around. But we realized as we extrapolated that, that meant paving over this whole valley with expanded suburban sprawl. And we realized that wasn't at all what we wanted, and realized that if, instead of spreading out, if we clustered closer together, that the feeling of openness in the natural environment would actually increase by clustering.
Most of the forested portions in the Cerro Gordo Valley are oak, cedar, and fir. Chris Canfield says the village will experiment with its own brand of sustainable forestry. Trees are harvested not just for building in the community, but also for income.
We have a forestry co-op that's been operating now for 6 years that does a selective thinning each year of no more than the annual growth. And using this system, you can come back into any one area every 6, 7, 8 years or so and thin out again another group of dominant trees. And you can keep doing that forever. So Cerro Gordo is trying to show that the ecosystem is the larger economy. And we can harvest trees for the lumber we use to build homes and to live in so many ways, but do it in an ecologically sensitive fashion.
The forestry co-op, the Cerro Gordo Wildlife Management Plan, which provides wildlife corridors for migration from the hill to the lake, and the cooperative bicycle trailer factory are all part of the Cerro Gordo experiment.
Cerro Gordo is never meant to be an escape for a lucky few. One of the most important reasons we're doing this project is to try to demonstrate the viability of some different land use patterns, because we want people to be getting together, trying to find a more symbiotic way of life. And Cerro Gordo as a project is just our contribution to that effort worldwide.
Chris Canfield says Cerro Gordo is open to anyone committed to working toward a sustainable community. Show. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Mention that you want program number 8.
Don't forget, this is your show too. Find out how to participate in Earth on the Air, or find out more about any of the pieces you heard. Here's our address.
It's Earth on the Air, P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. We had additional help from Craig McDonald, Susan Gleason, Ted Gates, Ted Jessen, Diane Michael, and Bill Svoboda.
Additional music was by David Hines and Randy. Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions and KCMU in Seattle, as well as KSER in Linwood, Washington.
Our show is distributed by Pacifica Program Service. For Earth on the Air, I'm Janice Kane.
And I'm Peter Maloff.